Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Abgenommen, bedauert.
Frequency. Thank you all for tuning in, and welcome to another episode of Mystery Frequency. What's there to be said about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's most famous creation? Nothing that hasn't been said already. So today's episode, the 1982 series, The Stories of Sherlock Holmes. If you enjoy this episode, please be sure to check out the other volumes of Sherlock Holmes in the archives, and also let me know through the comments on Spotify, through my email, mysteryfrequencypodcast@gmail.com, my social media, mysteryfreak, F-R-E-Q on Twitter, mysteryfrequency on Instagram. All those links and more are found in the descriptions. And if you enjoy this podcast, please be sure to follow, review, and rate. The higher the ratings, the more easier it is for people to find this podcast and enjoy these great stories. Now, with all that, please enjoy the show.
We present The Stories of Sherlock Holmes.
The Beaumont Affair. I'd heard of Lady Ada Fitzhugh, who in London, or for that matter, all England, hadn't. She was a famous beauty, had married into the peerage, and from that moment on become the model of autocratic behavior. Upright and self-disciplined, she had maintained the admiration of all when, after her husband died doing his duty in India, she had settled down to show society a standard that few could live up to. Her famous house in Mayfair and her country seat at Beaumont in Cumberland were well known. Few people were invited to them. When they were honored guests.
Good morning, milady. You are very welcome. May I introduce you to Dr. Watson, my friend and colleague for many years?
How do you do, Doctor? Yes, of course I've heard of you. Where may I sit?
Anywhere you wish. This chair is reasonably comfortable.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Holmes, I shall not bandy words with you. We are both too intelligent. I shall come straight to the point. I need your advice, and I'm willing to take it.
I'm willing to listen to anything you have to say.
I have a niece, Mrs. Blanche Lee. You may have heard of her. She's often commented upon in the society magazines, photographed for her flawless beauty. She is indeed the original English rose. No artificial devices at all. Quite natural. I'm very fond of her, although I think she's made a dubious marriage. However, that's not the point. Of late, she has been behaving in a most strange way. I've noticed it several times at my home here in Mayfair and at Beaumont. It distresses me. I fear she will fall from grace and popularity. I want you to investigate the matter. and I shall pay you whatever you require.
I am a criminal detective, milady. There seems nothing criminal to investigate in what you told me so far. You say your niece has been behaving strangely. May I ask you what now?
Well, she appears quite normal at most times. During the day, she's cheerful and full of vitality. But towards the evening, she wilts. She has yet to appear at dinner without lapsing into a form of a trance. I cannot insist that she's medically examined, and I doubt if that will give the answer. But I cannot describe it, Mr. Holmes. It's bewildering, as though someone is hypnotizing her, some sort of vessel possessing her.
Interesting. But it seems to me a case more for my doctor friend than for myself.
Well, perhaps. But I should value the opinions of both of you. Now, I'm holding a small house party at Beaumont this weekend, and Blanche will be present, though her husband has had to decline the invitation. Just a few selected guests. I should be happy if you and Dr. Watson would attend. An open check to your favorite charity will be the expression of my thanks. Well, Mr. Holmes?
I'm sure that had I not been present, Holmes would have rejected Lady Ada's invitation. As it was, the thin-lipped smile broadened. He had again read my mind and knew that I'd be delighted to go to Beaumont's. He accepted. Lady Ada advised the time of arrival and departed graciously.
Perhaps having come out of London would not be a bad idea, Watson.
An invitation to Beaumont's is an incredible opportunity, Holmes. It should be most interesting.
I wonder. I think Lady Ada knows far more than she's telling us. Mrs. Blanchley must be aware of these times when she's not herself. Why doesn't she discuss the matter more freely? Yes, it might, as you say, be very interesting.
Preparations were made. We caught the northbound train on Friday morning and arrived at Beaumont in the late afternoon. Lady Ada had sent a carriage to the station, and after being shown our rooms, we went down to the great hall where tea was being served, and where we were introduced to the other guests.
Mr. Roland Bean.
Hello.
Count Carl Wiesner. This is Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson.
How do you do?
And here is my niece, Blanche Lee.
It is indeed an honor to meet one so famous as yourself, Mr. Holmes. My husband has worked with your brother, Michael.
So I believe. It's a pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Lee.
Oh, please. Call me Blanche. I'm sure we can all be on first-name terms for the next few days. Oh, what a delightful company you have assembled, Aunt. Tell me, Count, have you brought the Lustspiel with you?
Yeah, he's up in my room. My lady knows that I never travel without him. Oh, I can't help it. He will pine away. Simply die if I leave him behind.
Oh, you really must meet that Lustspiel, Mr. Holmes. He is the Count's favorite pirate.
Is he very old, Count? They say nearly 100 years. No one can tell. Not even that Lustspiel himself knows.
Have you asked him?
Well, I have many times.
And what does he say?
Oh, he says, Too old.
Well, if everyone has taken tea, then perhaps you'd like to be shown over the estate.
Oh, yeah.
After that, we shall go our own ways until dinner. And that is at 8 o'clock sharp. So come.
The Beaumont estate was breathtakingly lovely, and I enjoyed the hour's walk. I had no time to speak privately with Holmes, but I could see him eyeing Blanche Lee quite keenly. She was indeed the most beautiful woman. Tall, slender, with black hair, and the bluest eyes I've ever seen. She was aglow with health. And yet, when we sat down to dinner, a subtle change slowly came over her. From being beautiful, she grew to old and disagreeable. Her dazzling smile vanished, and when she answered a question, her lips drew back in what was almost a snarl. Everyone noticed as the meal went on.
Would anyone care to ride tomorrow?
Oh, I would, Lady Ada. I always enjoy taking the horses out early. Count, what do you say?
Oh, my horse riding days are over, I'm afraid.
What of you, Blanche? We've ridden out early before. Come with me.
No.
We needn't go early. Any time you like.
I said no, and I mean no.
But
excuse me. Blanche! Are you all right? Blanche,
I'm quite. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone.
We were all horrified. Of course, the rest of the meal was a fiasco. Lady Ada did her best to set us at ease, but we were glad when it was over. Blanche had locked herself in her room, and there was no chance of me examining her. I hurriedly consulted Holmes. What do you think, Holmes?
What
cause that sudden transformation?
I don't know. As a medical man, what do you say yourself, Watson?
I hardly like to suggest it, but I can only think that the lady takes drugs.
Here's my own impression. But have you known any drug have that effect?
No, but there could well be one. You know, I'm a general practitioner, Holmes. I'm not a specialist on drugs. What can we do?
Well, nothing for tonight. Tomorrow after breakfast, I'll speak to Lady Ada. The first opportunity, I shall need to search Blanche Lee's room and all her personal effects. There must be something there that will tell me what I want to know.
With that, Holmes retired. I didn't know how well he slept, but I had a very troubled night. I simply could not forget the scene at the dinner table. In the morning, very reluctantly, Lady Ada agreed to Holmes' plan. Blanche had risen quite early. She appeared to be quite her old self and had gone off riding with Roland Dean. Lady Ada showed us to Blanche's room.
This is Blanche's room. I don't like to do this. It's wrong to search another person's belongings.
I believe in this case it is justified. Tell me, who has the rooms either side of this one?
Roland Dean has the one on the left. And Count Minchner, the one on the other side.
Count Carl Minchner and his parrot.
Yes.
Yes. There's no connecting doors and no common veranda. So much for the geography. Now to the examination. I must ask you, Lady Ada, to let me proceed up on my own. Do not touch anything. Watson knows my methods. Just leave all this to me.
I'd seen Holmes search a room and its personal effects many times. But I'd never known him be more thorough. Every article of clothing, every item on the dressing table, including jewelry, was subjected to close scrutiny through his powerful magnifying glass. Eventually, he rose, appearing more satisfied.
Well, I think that's all I can do at the moment. You will see that this investigation remains secret, will you not, my lady?
Oh, of course. For my own sake, as much as yours. Have you found out anything to present us, Mr. Holmes?
Perhaps. Will you excuse us now, lady? Come up, and I need a walk in the garden. And there we shall try a small experiment. An experiment that could well solve this whole mystery. And may I lead the way?
Sherlock Holmes led the way out of the house and into its grounds. He paced the lawns thoughtfully, occasionally looking up at the room he had just been searching. Then he chose a small summer house by the lake and motioned me to sit near him.
Sit down, Watson. Sit down.
Well, Holmes, what's this experiment you wish to carry out? What am I to do?
You are merely to stay here with me, Watson. Stay by my side, and whatever happens during the next few minutes, do not call to aid. Keep silent and watch over me. Remember, do not let anyone witness this or know of it. Just stay with me. Note down everything, and wait until I give you permission to walk back into the house. Do you understand and promise me this?
Well, yes, of course.
Very well.
With that, Holmes began rubbing his hands together, and then smoothing his lips, moistening them with his tongue, and breathing quite heavily. Slowly, a change came over him. His eyes lost their usual keenness. His jaw sagged forward. His whole complexion changed. It was exactly as Blanche Lee had acted at dinner the night before. I couldn't believe my eyes. Holmes, you all right?
Yes, Colonel, I'm all right.
But you look different. You sound different. Now, what's happened?
You're quiet. Mind your own business.
Holmes, this is dreadful. You look like I'm possessed. I can't just sit here and watch this happen. Look, I'm going to help. Someone must be told.
No, it's all right. No, do you understand? Didn't you promise me, you fool?
But what has happened? Surely you can tell me. Let me help you as a doctor. I should.
Will you not be patient? You can't hold your tongue and then take drive under the path. But if you said, don't call anyone. That is an order. You understand? An order.
I stood at the entrance to the summer house, guarding over Holmes as he sat back on the seat, his hands clenching the ivy-covered woodwork, his mouth open, his eyes staring into space. Eventually, he relaxed and appeared to slumber. I stood looking out over the water, almost in despair. And then I felt a hand touch my shoulder.
All right, Watson. Thank you very much. I think we can return to the house now.
Holmes. Thank goodness for that. You're yourself again. Whatever happened? I've never seen you like that. It scared me half to death.
Not as much as I myself was scared, I do assure you.
Whatever happened? What caused it all? And, well, can you recall what happened?
Oh, yes. But I cannot enlarge upon the matter at the moment, Watson. I shall be able to explain to you later. Meanwhile, it is sufficient that I have solved the mystery, and it only remains for me to set matters right here. I think I know a way of doing so. Come, back to the house. And not a word of this for so.
Yes, of course. But I've seldom been so bewildered, Holmes.
You have been a great help. But I must ask you to do two more things.
Very well.
One is to get into the nearest village and send a telegram to the house addressed to me. Word it so that anyone seeing it will think it is from London, recalling us both urgently. With a little luck, we may be able to catch the night train home.
Is that what you want?
It is vitally necessary. I promise you we shall have this case solved in the next 24 hours.
Oh, so it is a case. There is something criminal going on.
I would say it is. Nasty a crime as any outside actual murder. But come, I've wasted enough time. You go about your business, and I shall go about mine. We shall not meet until lunchtime. Good luck, Watson, and thank you again.
I did as Holmes requested. I found a post office in a nearby village and managed to make sure a telegram would get to Beaumont's that afternoon. Then I found Count Karl Münchner. I found he was a great authority in all kinds of birds other than parrots. And so it was easy to get him to walk through the woods identifying bird calls. We returned to the house to find Lady Ada in a state of great concern and confusion.
Count! Count, my dear Count! I really don't know what to say to you.
What is it, Rosemary? What is the matter?
It's your parrot.
What?
It is Das Lustspiel.
What has happened to him? He is not hurt, injured?
Oh, no. Nothing is wrong with the bird. Blanche, my dear.
What on earth is the matter? Why are you looking so distraught, Aunt? Count, what is wrong? We've had such a lovely morning.
I hardly like to say this, but that Lustspiel must have got out of the council room and somehow flown onto your balcony and entered your room, Blanche. He's made a terrible mess of things. Quite a lot of the brightly colored materials have been torn, and the dressing table is in complete disarray. Oh, please, you must come with me and see for yourselves, and let's hope that there's nothing missing, jewelry or anything of importance. So come quickly, I must have something.
Well, it's certainly a mess. But I don't think there's anything missing. There might be a few trinkets, a small comb, the pad I polish my nails with, that sort of thing. But nothing of importance.
Lustspiel, you are a very naughty boy. Very naughty, not so, yeah?
Oh, really? There's nothing to make a fuss about. Don't scold him.
But what I say is, the mystery, how did he get in here? Oh, Liebchen, you are too old to fly to this trick, you know.
I always thought the Count was too eccentric for words. Perhaps your aunt will put a stop to him bringing such pets down here after this.
Hope so. But no harm done, after all.
In the afternoon, the telegram arrived for Holmes, and he made a great display of regret at having to leave Beaumont's by the evening train. Lady Ada was clearly upset, but Holmes reassured her that there would be no more trouble, and her niece would never suffer the attacks of personality change again. With that, we departed. Holmes said nothing on the journey back to London. He slept most of the way. But once there, he hailed a hansom cab, and much to my surprise, gave an address in St. John's Wood. But Holmes, I can't understand this. What is it all about? Now, look, I've done my best to be patient, but I refuse to be treated like a child. I will accompany you no further without an explanation.
We're going to the home of Mr. Matthew Lee Watson. I'm sorry that I've had to inflict so much upon you. It has sorely tried your patience, but all will be revealed to you once we talk to Blanche Lee's husband. I know it's very late, but on the other hand, we're sure of finding him at home. It's quite essential that we talk before his wife gets in touch with him. Ah, this is the street, but not for long now.
I controlled my annoyance. I was too intrigued to desert Holmes at this age. It took quite some time to get a reply to our continual knocking, but eventually a disabled butler was persuaded to show us into Matthew Lee's library. And there, some 10 minutes later, the irate gentleman himself entered.
Now, look here, what is this? What the devil do you mean by knocking me up at this time of the night? You are Mr. Sherlock Holmes, are you not? Yes, I know your brother. Could never imagine him acting in this disgraceful manner.
On the contrary, Mycroft is far more ruthless than I am when it comes to criminal matters.
Criminal matters? What do you mean, criminal matters? What are you talking about?
Dr. Watson and I have just returned from a visit to Beaumont's, where your wife is spending the week as a guest of her aunt's. This, of course, you well know.
Oh, of course I do. Well, what's wrong? Something happened to Blanche?
No, that's no thanks to you. Why do you do it, Lee? Why did you try to discredit your wife in the eyes of her aunt and any guests she may have invited her to dine with?
I don't know what you're talking about.
No? No, perhaps this will remind you. Here, it's a small, round, jeweled container, rather like a locket. It opens so. And inside, we find what? A paste of some kind. It is your wife's. Do you know what she uses it for?
I think it's something she polishes her fingernails with, isn't it?
That's the excuse she may have made at one time, but your wife is famed for her natural beauty, isn't she? She does not wave her hair, or cream her face, or even powder her nose. The rose of England is quite natural. That is part of her beauty, and one of the reasons why most young men fall in love with her. Oh, yes. You're wildly jealous of Blanche, aren't you? She's something of a flirt, I can tell now. She completely bewitched that young Roland Dean, although he was rather put off when she acted so strangely at dinner last night. She appeared to be another person, a rather repulsive, rude, and ugly person.
I can't be blamed for my wife's peculiarities.
Oh, but you can. You know it for years now. The only type of beauty aid that Blanche has used is a lip salve. In the evenings, after dressing for dinner, she would gently smear a little of this ointment across her lips. It gave them a rosy glow and prevented them from feeling gapped and coarse. But you have often tampered with that lip salve, have you not? If this ointment were to be analyzed, the pharmacist would find it contains a rare alkaloid substance known as pyrrolidine. Large doses of it would induce fits, strokes, and even madness in human beings. Small doses cause irrationality, loss of memory, flashes of ungovernable temper, I know. I tested it out myself this morning. Watson will tell you that it changed me completely and for the worst. It is a foul thing that you've been doing to your wife. I judge it to be a criminal thing.
I admit it now. I must have been mad to have thought it out. I wanted to put an end to her incessant flirting and carrying on. I thought if she'd appear to be discredited in social circles because of her infamous behavior, it would make her turn back to me. I wanted her to appear repentant so that I alone could enjoy her attractiveness. I admit it now. I'm ashamed of myself. So what are you going to do, Mr. Holmes?
Leave you? And trust you to throw that container into the Thames. I think that is all. It's been a wretched story, and you are a wretched man. Come, Watson, time we went home.
Holmes and I returned to the Waiting Hansom, and as we clattered our way back to Baker Street, I asked Holmes how he came to clear the affair up so quickly.
I noticed Blanche's lips when she came in to dinner. They were the only part of her that was different. Of course, once she drank some wine, the poison entered her throat. She had no other beauty preparation on her dressing table but that small container. After I'd proved it by taking some of the stuff myself, I left that parrot out of the count's room and took it into Blanche's. I stole a few trifles to make it look as though the bird had been a thief. An unsavory case, Watson. With only one unsolved difficulty. How do I prove to Lady Ada that I've been responsible for saving her niece and can claim that open check without letting the cat out of the bag?
Listen again next Sunday to The Stories of Sherlock Holmes with Graham Armitage as Holmes and Kerry Jordan as Dr. Watson.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, anyone in here? Anyone mucking around in these stables? Come on now, I can see you there in the shadows. Come on, show yourself.
What are you going to do about it?
What are you doing here? These are private stables belonging to Mr. Paul Chester.
Too bad. I just lost my way, that's all. Sorry, bye for now.
Now, wait a minute. That ain't good enough. I'm sending for the police.
You won't cause any trouble if you're wise.
No. Well, we'll see about that.
You asked for it, mate. Right.
We present the stories of Sherlock Holmes.
The Porter Muse Mystery.
Sherlock Holmes was accustomed to dealing with mysteries and murders, but as far as I can recall, there was only one case where a death occurred almost on his doorstep. You see, running parallel to Baker Street is Chilton Street, and in between, at the back of number 221B, there is a small mews, Porter Mews. The stables are clearly seen from our back bedroom windows. Number 108 Chilton Street is owned by Paul Chester, an undersecretary at the Admiralty. And it was in his stable in the mews that the body of his coachman Ben Mead was found that autumn morning. Naturally, someone thought of Holmes immediately. And, not stopping for breakfast, we both hurried to the scene of the crime.
Constable, good morning to you.
Good of you to pop over, Mr. Holmes. Lindsay's his name. I'm standing guard here until the inspector arrives. Nothing's been touched since the alarm was raised.
Good, good. One of those rare occasions when I'm first on the scene and not the last to arrive. This is the man Ben Mead. Yes, I've often seen him at work down here. Tell me, has Mr. Chester been informed of this?
Mr. Chester doesn't seem to be at home, sir. The place is all locked up. That's how this man was found. The housekeeper arrived. She doesn't stay in the house. She couldn't get in, and so she came down here to find Ben. When in a flaming hysterics, she didn't call the police. She's next door, if you want to talk to her.
Later will do. Let me first take a look at the body and the whole stable. The horse and carriage aren't here. I take it that Chester has gone off with them. Now, the body.
Well, it must have been a fight, Holmes. Look at the way everything's been thrown about.
Oh, yes, there's been a fight, all right, but an unfair one. It seems to me that this poor fellow was knocked down, and then, before he had a chance to pick himself up, he was hit across the base of the skull with a heavy instrument. This man gave a good account of himself, according to his facial injuries. Blood everywhere, and look at his knuckles, and... Yes, what's this? Yes, a coachman's wheel hammer. Blood and hair on it, yes. This is the murder weapon, all right. Now, I need as much light as possible. Now, where's my glass? Yes, very interesting. Very interesting. Well, it's clear from the footprints in the earth by the door that Ben came in here and disturbed someone. I should say quite early last night. There was a fight. He inflicted some injury upon his opponent before he was knocked down. He was meaning, I should think, about here when the fatal blow was delivered. Yes, I think I'd like to go over everything alone, if that's all right with you. And then, when the inspector arrives, you can send him up to my rooms, Constable. I think I can put him on the right track straight away.
That's a relief to know, Mr. Holmes. Lucky to have you on the spot, so to speak. I'll tell the inspector straight away.
And so, about an hour later, as Holmes and I were finishing breakfast, Mrs. Hudson showed in our old friend, Inspector Lestrade.
Lestrade. I wonder that Scotland Yard has been called in on such a minor case of murder.
Morning, Holmes. Morning, Watson. Well, as a matter of fact, the powers that be heard you'd been at work, and they thought it might be more important than it first seems. Murder on the premises of anyone who's employed at the Admiralty has serious undercurrents.
Yes, but this murder occurred in the mews, in the coaching stables at the back of Mr. Chester's house. Nothing to do with Chester.
That's right. But what is not known is that the house was burgled last night. And the housekeeper was let in, and when they opened up the place, they found that all of the famous silver plate had been taken. Now, these two events cannot be unrelated, Holmes. The man who killed Ben Mead must have used the mews as an entrance to the house. There is, of course, a connecting gate and a pathway to the back door.
Yes, but let's get the sequence in the right order. Ben Mead investigated the coach house, was killed by an intruder, who then took Mead's key and went into the house and stole the silver plate? No, I think not.
Well, I don't know what order it happened in, but the two events must be connected. The coincidence is too great, don't you agree?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Well, Holmes, where do we start? Any ideas?
Oh, yes, plenty. It's a question of marshalling my thoughts. Now, let's take the death of the coachman as a start. You're looking for the murderer. He is approximately 5'8". He has red hair, and he has a tooth missing from the front of his mouth.
Holmes, you aren't serious.
Never more so.
But how did you arrive at these conclusions?
Oh, my dear Lestrade, you're as infuriating as Watson. You should know my methods by now. They are totally scientific. Nothing that I say is guesswork. I examined the coach stable in great detail. I found evidence. The fact that the dead man had put up a fight was very clear. He was bruised about the face. Now, bruises are very strange things. They come about in various ways. After death, for instance, they do not grow into blueness. The blood is not circulating. You understand? That's how we can tell the time when death occurred. Now, the knuckles of Ben Mead's hands showed definite, clear cuts. He'd landed several blows. Adhered to the blood on his hand were various hairs. I have them here in this envelope. They are, as you can see, rather vivid red hairs.
Yes, I see. All right, Holmes, carry on.
There's a broken tooth in that envelope also. I picked it up from the straw. It must have been from the man Ben was fighting, as Ben's teeth are quite intact. Also, on the beam of the stable, there were similar red hairs. They are also in the envelope. They show that if the man was hit and staggered back, his head would have hit the post at roughly 5.5 feet from the ground. That's reasonable to assume, therefore, that he is a small man. He must have had red hair and a beard. It's all quite elementary, really.
Something to go on, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. Now, London must have hundreds of men with red hair, but not all that many who also have broken front teeth. It narrows down your search somewhat, you must agree. Now, I would suggest, in view of the fact that there was also a robbery, that the man was hired to do this job, therefore he is a professional and an experienced crook. May I make one final suggestion?
By all means.
Try Limehouse. There's a gin hall near the river. It's called the Waterman's. It's a place where all kinds of seamen gather. At the back of the hall, there is an old coach house which is used as a boxing hall and gymnasium. I've long suspected that it's merely a front cover for various smuggling activities. If you can get a couple of plainclothes men to dress as seamen and ask a few questions, you could pick up the lead on the man you're after.
Well, that's a great help. Thanks, Holmes. I'll do exactly that.
Good. Well, the best of luck, Lestrade, and keep me informed, won't you?
Lestrade left, feeling rather pleased with himself. And I knew that if he succeeded in making an early arrest, Holmes would take none of the credit. In fact, Holmes appeared to lose all interest in the case until later that day when Mrs. Hudson showed in yet another visitor. This time, it was a man of considerable importance, Sir William Benningfield, of the Admiralty.
Good day to you, Holmes. I don't know if you remember me. We met a couple of times at the Diogenes Club. Your brother Mycroft introduced us.
Of course I remember, Sir William. Pray do take a seat and tell me why I'm so honoured by this visit.
Thank you. Well, the fact is that we seem to have hit a spot of trouble. This is, of course, in the strictest confidence.
Naturally.
It's my assistant, young Paul Chester, the fellow who lives just at the back of here.
The gentleman whose coachman was killed in a fight last night.
Yes, that's right. I don't know if that has anything to do with my problem. I can't see how it can have. But anyway, the fact is that Chester has disappeared. He can't be traced at all. But he should have been in the office at the Admiralty yesterday and today, but there's not a sign of him. We're very worried.
You think he also might have been attacked?
Huh? No, I don't think so. The fact is that for some time now, we've been aware that certain information has been passed on to foreign powers. Very vital information regarding the latest naval armory. As you know, we in Britain pride ourselves on our secret service, as best in the world. Information coming back to us leads us to believe that someone in the Admiralty has turned traitor.
And you suspect it's Paul Chester?
Oh, grave accusation, Holmes. I hardly like to put it in so many words, but the possibility does exist. Recently, I've been watching Chester. Only he and I have the keys to the safe where the codes are kept. Very few of us handle the top secret stuff. The codes are continually being changed. Now, I know Chester has been at work on certain papers. I am reasonably sure that he has been passing copies on to a contact in Austria. Your brother, Mycroft, is over there at the moment and has confirmed that the information is being leaked out there.
And you think that Chester may have got wind of this, that he might be aware that you suspect him?
That's right. I fear that he may be skipping out of the country with the latest plans. It's important that we find him and stop him.
You say that he's been missing for 2 days. He could easily be aboard a ship or even across the channel.
Could be. but we must check. The point is, Holmes, will you help us? I'm sure Mycroft would wish you to.
Yes, yes, of course. I shall do everything I can, Sir William. This case is becoming extremely interesting. Yes, I shall do everything I can.
Sir William Benningfield left, and I went about my own business. I had a large number of calls to make and didn't return to Baker Street until early evening. But Holmes was not at home. Mrs. Hudson had set the table for supper, and there was game pie and vegetables hot on the stove. I was helping myself to this when the door opened, and a shabby old tramp let himself in. I said, "Look here, my man, what do you mean by calling in here? How did you get in? Who are you, anyway?"
"You must be the doctor. Dr. Watson, ain't that right?"
"That is correct, but answer my questions. Who are you and what do you want? How did you gain entrance to these rooms?"
You really are my best audience, Watson. Oh, I always feel my disguise is a foolproof if you're taken in by them."
"Holmes, well, I must say that this is one of your better attempts. I was completely taken in. Well, what have you been up to this time?"
"Well, I thought I'd do a little checking up around the Limehouse district myself. The Strayed men stand out like sore thumbs down there. I spotted them in the Waterman's gin hall immediately. Fortunately, they made my own investigation pass unnoticed. Yes, I found Ben Mead's murderer, all right."
"You have?"
"Oh, yes. A very undesirable creature by the name of Joe Crum. He's exactly 5'8", has red hair and a beard and a front tooth missing. I've advised Scotland Yard, and Lestrade should be about to make an arrest, I should think."
"That's fast work, I must admit. Holmes, is there a connection between that man's death and the disappearance of Paul Chester?"
"I believe there must be. It's far too coincidental. Missing papers from the Admiralty, an undersecretary who disappears, silver plates stolen from his house, and his coachman is murdered all at the same time. No, no, no. There must be some link. But what is the link, Watson? That's the point. It's a far more complicated case than it appears. Ah, now that, unless I'm very much mistaken, will be our old friend Lestrade. Would you be so good as to let him in, Watson, while I change out of these things? Give him a glass of brandy and invite him to take supper with us. I shall not be long."
I did as Holmes instructed, for it was indeed Inspector Lestrade waiting outside on the doorstep. He accepted my offer of food and drink gratefully, and over supper told us of his success.
"We arrested the man, Joe Crum, Holmes. He's now in jail, and we're pushing forward his trial. But, frankly, I'm wondering if the evidence will hold. He's rather too circumstantial."
"Men have been hanged on far less evidence. He is a murderer, I've no doubt about that. Providing you have a good prosecuting counsel, I think you should get a conviction."
"Now, I'm not so sure. The man's attitude is so darn confident. He doesn't say much, just does a sly, lopsided grin. Refuses to comment at all. Simply says he's innocent, and that's that."
"He is not innocent, he is guilty. I've been down to Limehouse myself and picked up quite a few tidbits of information. Nothing that I can pass on to you to be used as evidence, but from what I learned, it confirmed all my suspicions. Joe Crum killed Ben Mead, and all that remains is for you to prove it, Lestrade. Now, would you like a little more game pie?"
Holmes promptly dropped the whole case. Several times I asked him if he was making any progress with his investigations into the disappearance of Paul Chester, but he merely said that the time wasn't right. Sir William Benningfield called a couple of times and was given more or less the same answer. I could see that he was disappointed in Holmes, but Holmes didn't let that worry him. He was concentrating upon other matters. Days went by, and even weeks, and eventually Joe Crum appeared in court on a charge of murder. Naturally, Holmes and I attended the trial. The defense was conducted by Hugh Starcross, the most able man.
"Members of the jury, you must be amazed at the weakness of the case you have been brought here to judge. In all my long experience, I have never known a criminal charge supported by such flimsy, scanty evidence. As it unfolds, you will see that no rational mind can find the prisoner guilty. My client is not content, however, to be acquitted for lack of evidence. He claims the right to prove his innocence. He will show that he could have had no part whatsoever in the death of the coachman, Ben Mead."
"That means he's about to produce an alibi. The usual questions first, though."
"A prisoner at the bar. You have heard that at the scene of the crime, there was evidence of a fight and the finding of red hairs and a broken tooth. You have red hairs.
That's right. Natural, too. Always have had this colour here.
You also have a front tooth missing. Can you tell the jury how you lost that tooth?
Waterman's Jim, Limehouse, boxing. Lost it about three months ago. Fella called Max Baker. Caught me one in the face and knocked me tooth out. Oh, that's Baker down there. He'll tell
you. Yes, yes. Just confine yourself to answering the questions. I shall bring the necessary witnesses to testify as I think fit. And now, on the night of the 21st, when this death took place, can you account for your movements?
Of course I can. I was in the Waterman's till about 10 o'clock. Then I went across to the pub. Three ducks. Stayed there till closing time, playing darts. Then went with the landlord to play poker. Had an all-night session. Oh, I won quite a bit, too.
So now we shall hear the confirmation from the landlord. Yes, he'll now be called. That's him, that large, fat-faced man with the black hair smarmed down. He will testify for Crump.
Holmes, you seem quite pleased that things are going so badly. This continues, and Crump will be acquitted.
Oh, yes, yes, I should think that's almost certain. Well, I think there's very little need to stay and hear more, Watson. The jury won't take all that long to make up their minds. We may as well go and get ourselves a cup of coffee, I think, don't you?
Gentlemen of the jury, have you arrived at a verdict? Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty, my lord.
Naturally, I was greatly upset, and so was Lestrade. Scotland Yard had been made to appear rather stupid. He was far from pleased and very much inclined to blame Sherlock Holmes, who was quite unimpressed by the whole of the proceedings. In fact, later that evening, he seemed rather pleased with himself.
Tonight, I think we can actually move on the case, Watson.
I thought it was all over. Crumb has been acquitted. Well, you may have been right in thinking him guilty, but he's got away with it.
Not entirely, not entirely. He's been made to reveal his hand, and I think now we can step in and solve the whole mystery. I've asked Lestrade and his men to meet me later. First, I have to send off a few telegrams. One to Mycroft in Innsbruck, another to the landlord of the Three Ducks, and a third to Sir William Benningfield. Then we journey to Limehouse, suitably clad, of course. I'm sure I can find an old suit that'll fit you, Watson, and a large cape with a pocket that can conceal a revolver.
You want me to come with you, or you think it might be dangerous?
That's right. I've been inactive for long enough. It's time things were brought to a head, don't you agree? Come, make preparations. It could be a long night ahead.
And so, on a rainy, windy night, Holmes and I took a cab to the east end of London, made our way by foot to the Three Ducks public house. We didn't go in. It was nearly closing time. We waited down a side alley. And after about half an hour, two men left by the back entrance. I could tell by the light of the gas lamps that they were Joe Crumb and the landlord. Swiftly and silently, we followed. They made their way down towards the river, and at St. Catherine's Wharf, they stopped and entered a small, disused warehouse. Holmes seemed to know the way, and catching me by the sleeve, guided me through the darkness. The two men lit a lantern.
There, see? They're kneeling on the floor, about to open a trap door in the floor.
Holmes, what's all this mean?
Shh, we'll find out very soon. Wait.
Close him in.
Good. Now, tomorrow, we're going to call the Santiago Star. Once we're out at sea, the captain drops it on the board and the man is there. We settle back in there and start collecting. Rich men, we're going to be nice and rich for the rest of our days. Worth taking a few risks for, I reckon, don't you?
One risk too many, Crumb.
Yeah, what a devil!
Don't move! There are two guns on you, and both my friend and I are crack shots. Cover them, Watson. Let's get Lestrade in here. He and his men have been following me. That's it. The game is up, Crumb. You may have got away with murder once, but this time you won't be so lucky. This time you will face a charge of killing Mr. Paul Chester, whose body you have just placed in that sea chest.
You blasty, clever sworn addict. You
will have plenty of time to listen to explanations later.
Oh, yes,
Lestrade. Good, right on time. Take these men away. Then I think you can make yet another arrest. A bigger fish this time. These are just two sprats to catch a mackerel. Come on, Watson. Our work here is over.
After the arrest of the two men in that warehouse, events moved at a bewildering pace. The body of Paul Chester was found, wrapped in canvas. It was clear that he'd been murdered, his throat cut from ear to ear. Under cross-examination, the landlord of the Three Ducks broke down and confessed everything. He turned Queen's evidence, and so implicated none other than Sir William Benningfield. Holmes was not at all surprised.
You see, it was Benningfield's whole idea. It was he who had turned traitor and was passing on the naval secrets. Paul Chester found this out and was ready to expose him. So Benningfield had to get rid of him. The plan was to burgle the house in Chilton Street, steal silver plate, and then send a message to Chester where to find it. Chester was lured to Limehouse, where he was killed, and his body placed beneath the floorboards of the warehouse until it could be shipped aboard a boat and dropped out at sea. Unfortunately, Joe Crumb was discovered by Chester's coachman, who was killed in a fight. I knew that it was the beginning of the case and not the end. Once Crumb was acquitted, he got overconfident. The landlord, being the spineless type, reacted to a telegram I sent to him saying Chester's body had been found. They led us to him. My brother Mycroft is due back in England straight away. He'll deal with Benningfield. I think our job is over, Watson. So much for the Porter Mews mystery. Interesting case, but a little too close to home for comfort. Don't you agree?
Listen again next Sunday to The Stories of Sherlock Holmes, with Graham Armitage as Holmes and Kerry Jordan as Dr. Watson.